I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. In a tweet at about 9 o'clock this morning, President Donald Trump said he called off an attack against Iran 10 minutes before the U.S. military was to have struck several military targets. The president said it was because a general had told him 150 people would die in the attack. Foreign Affairs columnist David Ignatius and Pentagon reporter Dan LaMotte of The Washington Post join us with the latest. Earlier this week, on a humid, rainy day in Orlando, Florida, thousands lined up to hear the president kick off his 2020 re-election bid. Ann Gearin of The Washington Post was at the rally. She joins us with the latest from the White House. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Disaster at Cockpit in Court. That's all coming up when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday and the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Early this morning, multiple news organizations reported that President Donald Trump ordered a military strike against Iran last night, and that while the mission was underway, he changed his mind and ordered U.S. forces to stand down. The raid was in response to Iran's shooting down a U.S. drone in the Gulf of Oman earlier this week. Iran claims the drone was in Iranian airspace. The U.S. denies that that was the case. At about 9 o'clock this morning, President Trump sent a series of tweets in which he confirmed that he, in fact, did call off the military strike. We'll talk to some reporters from The Washington Post today, one who covers the White House, another who focuses on national security. And I'm joined now by David Ignatius. He is a syndicated columnist for The Post and the author of 10 novels. David, welcome to Midday.
Thank you, Tom.
So what do you make of the fact that this strike was ordered and then reversed? That doesn't seem to happen very often. At least we don't find out about it happening very often. What do you make of it?
Well, I think there's been an intense debate, obviously, over the last 24 hours about what to do about the shootdown of the drone, but more broadly about Iran policy. The arguments for retaliating after the shooting down of a drone are obvious. You want to deter future actions of that sort. The U.S. argues that the drone was in international airspace. Iran contradicts that, but if the U.S. claim is correct, that's an act by Iran that you would want to retaliate against. I think that the thing that people need to understand is that President Trump has been convinced by his advisors, and I think believes himself, that he is playing a long game with Iran, that his most powerful weapon is not a kinetic strike against radar facilities that might have been involved in shooting down the drone, but the economic sanctions that are, as the phrase has it, crippling the Iranian economy. And he knows that the longer this confrontation continues, the weaker Iran will be in its ability to test the United States. Iran, by contrast, needs to strike hard. I think that's the theme we've been watching for the last month. So I think in a sense, we should take the president at his word. He decided at the end of the day that the attack, said it was not proportionate. He might kill 150 Iranians in response to shooting down an unmanned drone. But I think the key thing he said was he is in no hurry to take this action. Why? Because he knows he has the leverage.
And what do you make of Iran's posture in this, given the fact that these sanctions truly are crippling? I was talking to a friend last night, an Iranian-American who's an anthropologist who lives here in Baltimore, telling about the trials and tribulations that her family back in Tehran are experiencing. It's a very difficult time. There's shortages of medicine. There's shortages of food. It's just a very difficult time because of these sanctions. What then, from the Iranian perspective, is accomplished by shooting down a drone or allegedly, blowing up some tankers in the Gulf of Oman?
Obviously, we're inferring here, speaking to U.S. officials who have access to intelligence about Iranian leadership decisions and intentions. They say that the Iranians have concluded that their earlier hopes of waiting Trump out, of letting this period of sanctions continue without a strident Iranian reaction just aren't going to work, that the sanctions are biting harder and that Trump's political tenure may be longer than they'd expected. So it said that starting at the beginning of May, Iran adopted a new course, not one of strategic patience, but one of graduated escalation, moving, using proxies, but moving through the Houthi rebels in Yemen to attack Saudi oil pipelines. It argued attacking airfields in Saudi Arabia, attacking tankers that were anchored near the Straits of Hormuz in an attempt to create the kind of international crisis that would force the U.S. to engage with Iran. In other words, Iran has decided it needs to engage in some way to relieve this pressure of economic sanctions. Just to, again, make the point, we are in a state of economic warfare with Iran, and Iran's ability to sustain that over the coming months and years, it's obvious they think they can.
Is there also the possibility, does it appear, that the right wing in Iran, the religious leader, the Ayatollah Khomeini, is gaining support and, enjoying an upsurge in support, given that President Rouhani, who was certainly behind the Iran nuclear deal that Mr. Trump pulled out of, you know, promised all sorts of things would happen. None of those things have happened. Trump has pulled out of the deal. Does this embolden the Revolutionary Guard and the right in Iran in terms of their domestic politics?
I think you put your finger on one of the real problems with this policy. I reported in a column a month ago that Western intelligence analysts, I believe this is the view shared by the CIA analysts, believe that our sanctions, our get-tough policies, have strengthened the hand of the hardliners, not the opposite. So the IRGC, Ayatollah Khamenei, the powers that refuse any negotiation or compromise with the U.S., are in a stronger position now than they were. And I think that's part of what's troubling about this. I just don't see an outcome here short of conflict or some kind of turmoil in Iran that would make Iran another failed state in the Middle East. I don't think that's in America's interest. But I think that's the direction we're heading.
You wrote that there's an ironclad illogic at work here. There are, of course, people in the administration, John Bolton, first among them, who are very much in support of regime change in Iran. In your column you published yesterday, you didn't seem very optimistic about anything short of regime change happening that would, in fact, end this particular crisis, that either short of that or outright war.
Right now, I simply don't see the off-ramp, to use the cliche about negotiations. U.S. Trump administration tried to open a pathway for discussion, the Iranians would say, for capitulation, but the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe did go to Tehran just over a week ago, bringing a letter from President Trump, which was, as we understand, proposing a process of discussion about the outstanding issues, a longer term for the nuclear agreement, extension to cover regional issues, cover missile testing issues. That was spurned. Khamenei, the supreme leader, basically said, I am not going to talk to Donald Trump in any way. I'm not going to talk through an intermediary. I'm not going to do it. So that seemed to close that door. And again, I think the Iranian judgment is we've got to create a crisis that brings in the world, that shoots the price of oil through the roof, and then people say we've got to have some kind of de-escalation, and there's an international pressure for negotiation, and then they are able to move into a different phase that's less threatening them. Again, I think President Trump is, in a sense, resisting. Let's imagine that he'd go ahead and taken the strike this morning. What we'd be talking about is, were there civilian casualties in Iran? Iran would be saying this was a violation of international law. The U.S. would be on its back foot trying to defend it. Instead, U.S. continues, the sanctions are in place, the Iranians have the same dilemma they had 48 hours ago, which is how the heck are we going to get enough money to keep our economy going against this pressure campaign?
I know you got to go. I have one other quick question for you, and that is there any chance for some sort of independent commission to study and investigate what happened with the oil tankers, one Japanese, one Norwegian. I know Trita Parsi of the Iranian-American Council suggested if there was an investigation to really figure out who did this. The Iranians claim they didn't. The United States claims they did. Some of our allies agree with our assessment. But an investigation would provide a cooling-off period. Do you think there's any chance for that?
Well, ideally, the United Nations would be the forum for such an investigation. I think it's incumbent on the U.S., if it wants a broad coalition in support of its policy, resisting what it claims are these Iranian escalation efforts, to share more information so that the international community is able to make better judgments. I'm sorry, but the brief, sketchy footage of the IRGC patrol boat supposedly going up to remove one of the limpet mines from the hull of one of the tankers that was hit, that's just not enough to convince the world, especially in a period that's as delicate as this. So if the U.S. wants to build that coalition, you never know with Trump whether he likes coalitions or not, but if it wants that, and I think the U.S. should want that, then they got to put more on the table.
David Ignatius is an associate editor of The Washington Post and a syndicated columnist. He's also the author of 10 novels. David, thank you so much. Have a good weekend. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. Really enjoyed it.
It's Midday and the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. We're going to take a break. But before we take a break, a word about a comment that one of our guests made on Wednesday during our conversation about reparations for slavery. Adjo A. Iatoro, a lawyer from the National Coalition for Blacks for Reparations in America, or in COBRA, criticized Israel and the United States for walking out of the UN Conference on Racism in 2001. A listener, Dr. Stephen Pomerantz, wrote to say that Israeli and U.S. delegations left the conference because of a line in a long resolution that the conference was proposing that equated Zionism with racism. Dr. Pomerantz pointed to a report at the time on the PBS NewsHour. He wrote in part, quote, "Thank God the U.S. stood up to the U.N. on this one. Israel and the U.S. did try to change the resolution, but when that failed, they had to pull out." Your listeners didn't hear that, only a message that basically said that Israel and the U.S. are not only not fighting racism, they are going the other way, end quote. The withdrawal from the conference by the U.S. and Israel overshadowed news coverage of the conference itself, which was held in Durban, South Africa. In the PBS NewsHour report that Dr. Pomerantz referred to, Wall Street Journal reporter Doug Blackman said it was a little difficult to identify precisely why the U.S. and Israel pulled out. Blackman said, quote, "There are a lot of parties who maintain that the U.S. was also concerned about facing issues having to do with slavery reparations." So we will post on our website a link to that interview with Doug Blackman on the PBS NewsHour and a link to the Durban Declaration that was adopted at the 2001 UN World Conference Against Racism. In the meantime, we appreciate Dr. Pomerantz for taking the time to write. We always appreciate listener feedback. You are welcome to leave your comments anytime on our website, wypr.org/midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us when we come back from a quick break. More on the Iranian-U.S. tension that manifested itself last night with an aborted military strike that never happened in Iran. We'll be right back.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall. We're joined now by Dan Lamott. He covers the Pentagon and the U.S. military for The Washington Post. Dan, I know it's a very busy day. Thank you so much for your time.
Yes, thank you very much.
So what's going on at the Pentagon this morning? Anything, any news to add to what we've learned since 9 o'clock in the president's tweets?
It's honestly a lot slower. It seems as though the foot's been taken off the gas pedal, at least for the moment. There's a lot of sort of postscript discussions of how we get to where we are. The president kind of laid bare a great level of detail, really, in his tweets this morning what would have happened. And that holds up talking it through with defense officials.
What about the president's claim that even after the raid had started, planes were on their way, cruisers were in the seas on their way, with 10 minutes to go before the strikes were to take place, a general informed him that 150 people might die in such a strike. Is that a credible claim?
The number in particular is something that, you know, we've been chasing those sorts of specific details. I don't have anything that confirms it or knocks it down at this point. But certainly the plan of a strike, likely involving U.S. naval assets, was well underway. The expectation is it would have been carried out, and it was called off.
It seems a little strange to me, knowing not a whole lot about how this process would work, that the notion of casualties, be they civilian or military, would have come up before the strike was authorized, right?
It would have been a part of the discussion. So whether it waited that long is one question I have. Another question I have is whether or not that number changed. As they're developing these targets, a lot of times that they're watching them for several hours. Yeah, so it becomes, okay, where was this target? Were they mobile sites? Were there civilians nearby? How many people were on a military base, if that was one of them? And were those just numbers that the president was not comfortable with?
And you all published a story this morning just a few minutes after the president's tweets. What do we know about the Iranian reaction to the events of last night?
It's been sort of muted, and the question I think now becomes, and David Ignatius alluded to it, is what does Iran do? And it seems like the Pentagon for the moment is sort of standing by. Obviously there's a great deal of attention on all of this. The drone getting shot down this week was an eye-opener, but it also kind of laid bare something else, which is that, over the last several weeks, the military has put a lot more surveillance assets in the region and is, really trying to pay a great deal of attention to what exactly is happening there.
You reported that the Revolutionary Guard, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard's top commander, Major General Hussein Salami, said that the downing of the drone a couple days ago was a clear message to America. That message doesn't seem particularly clear to me. Do you have any idea what that message is intended to send?
No, I don't. Aside from, for me, they are trying to rock the boat because they are not happy with where things stand as a result of both the sanctions and the United States walking away from the nuclear deal.
You referenced a report in Reuters that said that the Iranians had been advised of the attack prior to its happening through Oman. Can you tell us anything more about that reporting?
I can at this point. One detail that has become clear is that there was discussion of whether or not Iran also was interested or considering targeting an American surveillance plane with Americans aboard, a P-8. And I'm told that there was indeed a P-8 airborne that night. Whether or not they actually were targeting it or considering striking that instead of the drone is, at this point, I think, pretty firmly in, Iran's hands. And the United States it did indeed have a plane there as well.
Iran mentioned that plane as an example of the restraint that they showed in only shooting down the unmanned drone. They also said that there were 35 people in the plane that was accompanying the drone. Is that a credible claim? Is there a way of them knowing, how many passengers are on a plane that's flying next to a drone?
It strikes me that they would have an estimate. I mean, the P-8 is a very large plane. I mean, it's basically based on I believe the 737. I mean, it's an airliner-sized plane, with a great deal of sensors on it, and it's designed to watch a broad area of ocean below it. But it's not a plane that is going to be flying evasive maneuvers or anything like that. I mean, it flies like an airliner.
In terms of the people in the administration that we are aware are advocating for military action against Iran, we know John Bolton, Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, Gina Haspel, even of the CIA, Lindsey Graham, Senator from South Carolina, all seem to be in favor of military action against Iran. Is that your understanding, number one? And number two, if those four very powerful voices in the president's ear were encouraging him to do this, why do you think he changed his mind at the last minute?
Uh, certainly we've had the sense that, you know, they are leaning in that direction. I don't know if I would be as confident going, you know, in that direction of saying that they firmly were in favor of specific kinds of strikes. But yes, that they were advocating for some sort of response. The question partly is this all comes at a time when the Pentagon is you know, transitioning from one acting defense secretary to another as a result of the news with Patrick Shanahan leaving the Pentagon earlier this week. So you've got kind of a leadership shift, if not crisis, in the Pentagon right now as well. And, you know, that's a voice that typically would have a lot of sway. And at this point, it's hard to say it does.
And right now, Mark Esper, the Army Secretary, is now the acting Defense Secretary. As you mentioned, this would be the third Defense Secretary in 3 years. How does that, unsettled circumstance at the top of the Pentagon affect the decision-making process for something like this? Has any official at the Pentagon shed any light on as to how it went down this time, given the fact that there's been all this turnover?
Those are the sorts of details we're chasing today. Esper actually takes over at the end of this weekend, so it's still Patrick Shanahan in charge for the time being. Yesterday, they were both at the White House. They went together, so you have sort of this unusual arrangement where you're in the midst of sort of a left seat, right seat transition, the military would call it, where you've got one guy trying to learn the job on the fly as quickly as possible. Esper's, you know, deeply experienced with national security issues, but it's, you know, pretty much anyone you would talk to would tell you the jump to the Secretary of Defense position is a massive one. So to learn on the fly, sort of the, you know, as you move from within the Pentagon to running the Pentagon is no small thing.
Yeah, indeed. Just finally, has anybody at the Pentagon made any particular comment about the signal that it sends to Iran that this strike was ordered, and then troops were told to stand down?
The Pentagon has largely been quiet. I think they've sort of let the president speak for it, and I think they're disinclined to get in the way of that or elaborate in a way that, you know, could be contradicted later. So at this point, you're left with a scenario where things have been kind of laid bare in a level of detail. The Pentagon does not typically do so, especially so early on. And, you know, it sets up a scenario where certainly the possibility of a strike remains on the table, and I think they're inclined to kind of just leave that hanging out there as an option and hope that things sort of de-escalate.
Dan Lamott covers national security and military affairs for The Washington Post. He joins us from the Pentagon on a very busy day. Dan, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to turn now to Ann Gearin. She covers the White House for The Washington Post. Ann, welcome to the show. Thanks for your time.
Hi. I'm glad to be here.
What's the scene at the White House this morning? Are they making any comments about the events of last night?
They're not really. It's actually sort of weirdly quiet here. The president has no public events on his schedule until very late this afternoon when he hosts members of Congress for a congressional picnic. We just went outside to see the scene for that, and it's, tables and tents with buffet lines getting ready and so forth on a beautiful afternoon, but no sign of him yet or any of his top aides.
Given the fact that Sarah Sanders, the press secretary, has announced her resignation, but is there any hope for a press briefing? I know those have become a very rare event in the White House. Has anything changed in terms of the daily function of the press office at the White House since the announcement by Ms. Sanders that she's going to be stepping down?
No, I mean, we can hope that that there'll be a briefing today, as every day, but not. One doesn't look likely today. I think to the larger point of your question, the White House appears to have shifted in a way that I don't expect to change toward. Not doing a daily press briefing, not having that expectation of doing one. And, of course, the president himself speaks to us or in front of us nearly every day. It's not the same thing at all as having a press secretary up there to whom you can ask a lot of follow-up questions and hold the White House accountable in a different way. But their answer is, look, you know, he's out there every day. In effect, their answer is he's his own press secretary.
It's the Midday News Wrap. I'm Tom Hall, joined on the phone from the White House by Ann Gearin, who covers the White House for The Washington Post. Ann, you were in Orlando, Florida a couple days ago for the rally that President Trump used to kick off his 2020 reelection bid. Paint a picture for the scene both outside and inside the Amway Center down there in Orlando. What was the mood?
The mood was really upbeat and lots of energy for the president. There were it's a sports arena, one of the largest venues he has used recently, and this was definitely among his largest rallies ever. That was clearly done by design. The place was packed. The campaign had handed out lots of small placards for the crowd to wave, made a great TV shot. Production values were higher than they are for his the kinds of rallies he does pretty routinely in airport hangars and so forth. It was clearly intended to be at an event. There was a lot of energy. He seemed energetic. He seemed pumped up. Both of his sons spoke before he did. They seemed pumped up. It was a full-on high-energy running for re-election announcement, which frankly is something he didn't have to do as an incumbent, but chose to do, and clearly thought the campaign clearly thinks it's worth doing, in large part to keep his own political supporters, his base of supporters, motivated and excited.
And, of course, it's pretty well known that he himself is not opposed to adulation from time to time. I think he likes these rallies. The themes that he
hit, loves them.
He certainly
he
does.
Loves them.
And, you know, the themes that he struck in this rally were very reminiscent of the same themes that he used beginning, 4 years ago this week when he rode down the escalator and announced his campaign.
Yeah, I mean, we wrote a little bit about this in the context of the re-election announcement. It's a bit of an awkward line that he has to walk now. He is running as an incumbent, so by necessity, he is running on a body of work that he calls, obviously, a lot of achievements, and he can point to strong economic performance. He can point to a number of other boxes checked on campaign promises. And so he's doing that at the same time as he is also running on some of the same basic themes that he ran on in 2015 and 2016, namely immigration enforcement, a kind of America First nationalism that he has partly acted on as president and partly not. So he's got in many ways a much broader portfolio to run on, and he ticked through a lot of that on Tuesday night. But he's also mindful, clearly, that a lot of people who voted for him the first time did so out of a sense of economic and social grievance or alienation that he needs to continue to address and continue to promise to remedy in order to get their vote the next time.
And, you know, clearly, I think one can make the case that he has checked the box when it comes to his promise to appoint particular kinds of judges to the judiciary, not just the Supreme Court, but throughout the federal judiciary system. He can point to his promise about deregulation. If you look at the stock market, if you look at the EPA mm-hmm. and other agencies, can he check the box on immigration? I mean, it was all about building a wall and basically ending illegal and even impeding legal immigration. Is that a box that his supporters think he has in fact checked?
Well, he's trying to fuzz that up a little bit. You're exactly right that the other things are box check ready. And in many cases, the other things you mentioned, deregulation and judges chief among them, have broader appeal among Republicans than his immigration policies. The immigration policies and the sort of associated inward-looking view that an America First view that goes along with them appealed in 2016 in many cases to people who were self-identified Democrats and to whom deregulation and Supreme Court justices are at best a lower rung issue. So to appeal to those folks again, the economic nationalists. Is one term that people use. Trump voters is another, Trump-based voters. To appeal to them on the immigration front, he is continually claiming that we are building the wall, building being a somewhat fuzzy term. There are some bits and pieces, parts of a wall, but certainly not the project that he's outlined in any way. Much of what he says he has built or is building is actually existing infrastructure that they may be repairing or sprucing up a bit, but it's not a new project that he is doing. But by saying in very forceful terms, we are building the wall, we're doing this and we're doing that, he keeps that momentum going. But he cannot say, and he doesn't, that this is a done deal.
And, of course, repeated millions of times was the fact that Mexico was going to pay for this wall. This seems
they don't say that anymore.
Yeah, exactly. And this seems to be one of those things that his supporters are willing to overlook, to be sure. It's interesting that the president is, sort of playing the greatest hits at these rallies. I wonder, do you think that these themes are going to continue to have legs, given the fact that not only did he campaign on them for nearly 2 years the last time around, but he's been repeating them at very similar rallies through his presidency these first couple of years of his term? I mean, is there any danger? Does the White House have any fear that, the act's going to get old?
Yeah, the old adage that every hero becomes a bore in the end, right? I mean, I'm sure they're mindful of that to a degree. Certainly wasn't in evidence at the Amway Center in Orlando. It was nothing but high spirits and strong support for the president. I mean, as you would expect, these are people who had waited in line and gone some distance and taken some effort to be there. Obviously, they're going to be enthusiastic. But it's those folks and their friends who the campaign needs. I mean, remember, he won by a razor thin amount, and he his Electoral College victory belies the fact that it was extraordinarily close in the popular vote, and that Hillary Clinton actually won the popular vote. They have to not only line up almost exactly the same set of slightly improbable states they did last time, but they have to keep the energy and enthusiasm level up in the borderline states. Florida is obviously always a battleground state and always a must win for the presidential victor. That's the easy explanation for why this rally was held in Florida. But he will be concentrating much of his effort from here forward in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, the states he won last time that he needs to win again in order to have the same edge.
Yeah, at one point a week or so ago, he referred to 17 battleground states. I, for one, didn't realize we had that many. I knew we had a few, but I thought that was a pretty big number for battlegrounds.
Yeah, that's a bit aspirational, but he's not the first to do that.
Yeah.
And of course, in the heady days of mid-2016, when it seemed like Hillary Clinton was rolling along to a certain victory, her campaign started talking about Arizona and Texas as potential swing states, which they, but just to be clear, they are not.
Yeah. And it's interesting that the Democrats are running on climate change. They're running on, you know, very different set of issues that, than the president is choosing to run on. And the president seems to be most concerned with this large field of Democratic candidates with Joe Biden. And Joe Biden's campaign so far has been one of style over substance, saying that we need to make America America again. And we need to make the Trump administration this bizarre anomaly in the history of the country. We need to get back to normal. The White House seems to be concerned about that. So are they concerned about the president's shoot from the hip style and, you know, the fact that he is so unpredictable and disruptive?
Yeah, to the degree that Biden's chief argument is civility and electability, that is a direct challenge to the president on style. I mean, Biden, like the rest of them, obviously has an argument against the president on substance, too. For Biden, that is true's natural territory is foreign policy. We've heard Biden talk about the president's dangerous and reckless foreign policy in Biden's framing. But his main argument so far at this early point is, look, you know, the president is doing damage that we can't even see to the fabric of the country, to our international relations, and so forth. That is the civility argument. That is the return to a more predictable, less erratic presidential style, and that is something that the president's advisors pay attention to. I mean, it is a knife edge there, because part of his greatest appeal to many of his very strongest supporters is exactly that he isn't that guy, you know, that he isn't boring, conventional, do it like it's always been done, presidential material. That's why they voted for him in the beginning. Nobody wants to try to clip the president's wings. Nobody who works for him wants to try to clip the president's wings too much. For one thing,
we've seen how that works out. Yeah.
Yeah. And secondly, it could backfire on them politically very quickly.
The fact that the economy is as strong as it is, the basic, the main indicators, the stock market set another record yesterday, unemployment is low, interest rates are still pretty low, despite the president's protestations that they could be even lower.
that was a funny moment yesterday that was kind of undercovered. He's like, it took him long enough.
Yeah, exactly. Can the Democrats, what's the Democrats' challenge? And I know we got to let you go here, but what's the Democrats' challenge in painting the economy in a negative light, given those kinds of indicators?
They're just trying to talk about other things. I mean, there are some Democrats in the middle and bottom of the field who are talking about this as a sugar high economy that can't last, and that the size of the debt and deficit both are out of control, and that the trying to make the fiscal responsibility argument. We actually don't really hear a lot of that at the very top of the Democratic field at this point. Elizabeth Warren talks about it to a degree, but they know that the Democrats know that at this point their strongest card to play is not talking about the economy, because it looks pretty good on paper.
Yeah, we're back to climate change, healthcare, infrastructure, that kind of thing. Great.
Well, yeah.
Ann Buren, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for your time. I know things are busy every day at the White House, one way or the other, a press briefing notwithstanding. So I appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
Ann Buren covers the White House for The Washington Post. It's the Midday News Wrap. By the way, coming up Monday, another installment of our Midday in the Neighborhood series, in which we visit with community activists in every neighborhood in Baltimore to learn about what's great about where they live and the challenges that their communities face. On Monday, I'll be speaking to folks from Ridgely's Delight, Greenmount West, and Canton. And a reminder that if you are involved in your community, perhaps as part of your neighborhood association or another organization, please be in touch with us so that we can have you on to tell your story here on Midday. Send us an email to midday@wipr.org. theatrereview.org. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up next, a theater review from Midday critic J. Wynn Russick. She'll tell us about Disaster at Cockpit in Court. It would be a disaster if you didn't stick around to hear it. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.